Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Bringing you up to speed on the latest in conservation, science, and responsible hunting in Canada. Hey everyone, it's Mark Hall, and you're listening to the Round Canada Podcast. The work that we do at Blood Origins Canada is helping hunters move away from being passive advocates to becoming a formidable force of activists that have truth on our side. So we provide education, background information, facts, and truth about hunting and hunters in Canada. We try to inspire hunters to take action. Sometimes we have formal calls to action. And we're asking hunters, in some cases, to take personal responsibility and take action on something that directly affects the conservation of wildlife, habitat, or the future of hunting. We work with Howl for Wildlife out of the U.S. They themselves have become a formidable force of change on the hunting landscape in North America. Howl basically takes information from campaigns that we write and others all across North America, and they turn it into a form of direct social action. And they do that by creating these action campaigns so that the power to drive change is based on sheer numbers of hunters that engage decision makers and elected officials. Because at the end of the day, that's what really matters the most to the future of hunting and to wildlife conservation, is the sheer number of voters who politicians are hearing from. Part of the bigger strategy that we're all working on, a number of different groups in North America, is we're working on this premise that we need to shift the thinking in our hunting community from a place where people say, it doesn't affect me, so I don't want to get involved, and shift that to a mindset of it does affect you and you need to get involved. That's where the mantra Howl Across Borders was developed with the Howl for Wildlife campaigns. The border between our countries doesn't matter. Hunters are taking action for hunters. All of this is super encouraging to me because I see hunters are creating a huge social movement, and hunters are becoming a powerful force at driving change. That's the difference from being passive advocates to active activists. So this is why, with this episode, I'm going to step outside of Canada and provide some thoughts on a trending story coming out of the United States. I've been trying to process this incident with the wolf in Wyoming. It's easy to get emotional and lash out. I've seen that on social media. So like most of these topics, my mantra is I'm going to go slow in order to go fast. So I've been trying to do my due diligence and run some issues to ground and learn and understand everything that I can of what is available right now on this story of the wolf in Wyoming. I don't profess to know everything and the nuances of hunting and the situation in the States. Like I said, I tried to do my due diligence. If I've missed anything here, feel free to let me know, because I do acknowledge there are people out there closer to this issue and closer to the heart of the matter that will know more. I'm open to hearing and learning and even changing what I'm about to say. It seems our understanding of this event in Wyoming is unfolding and changing every day since it happened a few days ago. More information is coming to light. So where I'm at today with my understanding of everything, I've got one main message that I want to boil this episode down to. But first, I'm going to kind of back up and walk through some background and some premises to where I want to lead to with my conclusion. But upfront, to me, this incident of this wolf in Wyoming and the bar scene and stuff, this isn't about one man and what he did to one wolf. I'm seeing a lot of effort by the hunting community to distance themselves from this incident, from the hunter, and from this story. This is not hunting. This is not what hunters do. This does not represent all of hunting. And to a great degree, that's true, because there was a part of this incident in Wyoming that was illegal. Beyond ethics, there was an illegal act that took place. So hunters do have a right to distance themselves from that aspect of it. But we can't distance ourselves from this entire story, because the heart of this issue is about hunting and fair chase, and then the fact that we, the hunting community in North America, have condoned something for decades that is not fair chase, and it is not in keeping with the ethics of the peer group of the hunting community. Mostly what this is about to me is hunters turning a blind eye towards the legal hunting practice of running coyotes and wolves down with snowmobiles. It's legal in Wyoming and Montana. I don't know about other places. In Wyoming, I am to understand, correct me if I'm wrong, it is legal in parts of Wyoming to run coyotes and wolves down with snowmobiles. It is a legal form of hunting. In Montana, it's legal in places in Montana for coyotes. A legal form of hunting take is running coyotes down with snowmobiles. If there are other jurisdictions in North America that this is legal, I'd love to know about it as well. I suspect this is new to you, and it's probably quite shocking. But that's part of my job here, is to create education and awareness so that you're able to formulate your own opinions, informed opinions. If you didn't know about it before, that's okay. Like I said, you know about it now. I've just learned about it. What I want to address here is how long hunters have known about this and the risk to hunting should this blow up in the public discourse and not said anything about it, not fought vigorously to have the laws changed, because they represented a tremendous liability, vulnerability, and risk to hunting. Maybe the hunting of coyotes and wolves maybe the broader acceptance of hunting in a particular state or wider. How long have hunters known about this and chosen not to take this on? So there were bills in Wyoming and Montana to prohibit the use of snowmobiles for running coyotes and wolves down. They were defeated in 2019 and in 2023. I don't know if these bills were sponsored by hunting organizations. Again, if they were, fill me in, let me know. That would be awesome if they were. Some of the stories that I've found and dug into, there were hunters involved in these campaigns pushing for these bills, saying, hey, this is not right. But like I said, for whatever reason, the bills were defeated. I don't know where the lobby was coming from. But like I said at the outset, these loud voices and action campaigns that are sheer numbers of people and voters is where politicians and political decisions will go. So I don't know where the influence came from in the 2019 and 23 decisions. So my interpretation of the stories that I have read on the Wyoming incident is that the individual involved is alleged to have ran this wolf down with a snowmobile. And reading between the lines in a couple of the different articles, it appears to me that the wolf's spine had been broken. It was paralyzed. So that's why this person was able to take the animal, tape its muzzle shut, and take possession of it. This is a hard thing to process, that somebody would do this. I think if there's any solace in what actually might have happened is, like I said, it seems pretty likely to me that this animal was paralyzed, and it was probably in shock so bad that it may not have had the ability, the cognitive ability, to perceive what was going on around it. There is a phenomenon in wildlife capture science projects where animals will die of a phenomenon called capture myopathy. Some animals are so stressed, their bodies go into this state of shock from being captured and held alive by humans, that once they put the radio collars on the animals, bring it out of the anesthetic and release it, the animal dies some point after that. It's a type of shock. I don't think scientists really understand what capture myopathy is, but there's something about a live animal being handled by humans in some situations that's traumatizing, that kills it. So in this case, I'm praying that this animal just didn't have the cognitive ability to be aware, of what was going on. Aldo Leopold in Sand County Almanac has a pretty powerful section about the time he shot and killed a wolf. I got up to it. It was still alive. I think it was a female wolf he described. And it was, I'm just kind of paraphrasing, but it was something along the lines that he looked into this bright green eye. There was a live, living animal, and kind of watched the fire go out. And that kind of forever changed his perspective on what he did, in hunting a wolf. I recently read several articles that are been published in the last couple of days in the United States that is highlighting this method of hunting, the fact that running coyotes and wolves over is a legal form of hunting. One of the articles I just read this morning, it's April 9th, provided a hyperlink to an Instagram account called Chasin' Fur. Chasin' chasin_fur. They're an Instagram account that's been active since 2017. They don't have a lot of posts, but their brand is about the whole form of hunting, of running coyotes down with snowmobiles. There are videos of them doing this, screen captures at the moment that a coyote is going underneath the hood of a snowmobile. They sell hats and t-shirts that have a graphic of a snowmobile running a coyote down. One of the posts I saw was about children that they were teaching to run coyotes down in these open fields and crusted snow, running them over with the snowmobiles. One thing that I've been proud of as a father who is a hunter is that I raised my kids with hunting from the earliest age, little toddlers in snowsuits, taking them out hunting, mostly trying to teach them how to be quiet. But I taught them that hunting leads to killing, but it's not done with vengeance or hate or disrespect. Killing and hunting is done with the highest level of reverence, respect, and dignity for wild animals. My kids, because they grew up like this, and I did as well, my kids never abused or tortured wild animals or pets. They never wounded birds with BB guns or pellet guns. They never caught frogs and salamanders and put them in a Tupperware container and then forgot about them in the summer sun, and these living animals baked to death in a container. These are the types of things that I've seen kids from families that were not raised in hunting families do to living creatures. My kids never did. And I consider that to be a virtue of being a hunter. Is that, yes, we kill living things, but it is done with a higher level of respect and dignity and humaneness than what any non-hunter or anti-hunter does in their treatment of wildlife. Right down to the fact that my kids, for most of their life, helped my wife drive 45 minutes into town every day because we lived out of town. And all my kids did the entire way there in the morning and the entire way back at nighttime is help my wife watch for wildlife on the highway and avoid having a collision, because they cared that much, cared about their safety. My wife obviously did. The kids cared about the animals. And so it was all eyes on deck. There's an organization in the States called Project Coyote. They're one of many organizations that focus on advocacy campaigns around predators and banning predator hunting and trapping. Project Coyote has used these videos that are on YouTube and on accounts like the one that I just mentioned in their campaigns. And fair enough, you know, it's real. And to me, it's not the issue that hunters are making these videos available. We hear all the things, stop putting this stuff on social media, stop putting this stuff on social media. Yeah, that's a part of the argument. But for me personally, whether or not it goes on social media, the fact that it's actually happening in real life to me is the troubling part. Because for one incident, like the Wyoming wolf thing or video that you see that Project Coyote uses, there's probably hundreds that are happened and they're going to happen next winter where they don't put it on social media. And to me, that's the issue, because that's what the animal experiences. The animal doesn't experience something harsher because a person happened to post it on social media. The fact that this is happening in real life is the troubling part for me. Feel free to source out that Instagram account and express your thoughts. I do believe part of the responsibility here is the peer community talking to one of its own and expressing thoughts, in a proper way. This fella in Wyoming is getting death threats and all that, like the Cecil the Lion dentist hunter guy did or whatever. That's not going to help. It was a terrible thing. Where the peer community can act responsibly is calling out one of its own, looking for whether or not the person acknowledges what their peers are saying, accepts responsibility for doing something wrong, owns it. And in that case, if they do, I think a good person would always give anybody a path to redemption. That is a phrase that I heard Joe Rogan say on a podcast about people that were being canceled for saying things on social media, particularly Twitter, before Elon Musk took over. And he kind of basically said, if you own your mistake, we owe it to people as good individuals a path to redemption. So anyways, I think it has to start with the conversations of expressing your thoughts as a member of the peer community. So what was this incident in Wyoming? So like I said, my understanding from reading all the articles is it started with the fact that the fella ran the wolf over with a snowmobile, which was completely legal. Everything up to that point was a legal form of hunting. If I understand this right from the research that I've done, in the places in Wyoming and Montana where it's legal to do this with a snowmobile, it's legal to run the animal over and kill it there, or to leave it wounded after it's been run over. I found that strange, that if that was the case, if it was legal to just run it over and, you know, break its back or a leg and, you know, or whatever, and keep going. So if you do know these laws a bit better, again, this is another one, let me know if I interpreted this wrong, or maybe the source that I got it from was wrong. But anyways, whether or not it's legal to wound the animal after running it over and not dispatch it humanely, kind of isn't the main point. The main point is that the use of a snowmobile running these animals over is legal. So my interpretation of the Wyoming story is ran the wolf over, it broke its spine, he was able to then tape its muzzle and took possession of the animal alive and transported it. That was the illegal part. It's $250 fine. Now, in wildlife infractions, there isn't this, well, this part was legal and that part was illegal. If the end result is that you're in possession of an illegal animal, everything that you did to take possession of that animal illegally becomes an illegal act. So in this case, everything, at least in my understanding of law, at least Canadian wildlife law, that everything would be an illegal part of it, which is why in law enforcement situations, everything that's involved in the illegal possession of an animal is potentially subject to the enforcement actions. That's where the confiscation of vehicles comes in, hunting rifles, boats, so on and so on. If they were all integral to the part of the illegal possession of an animal, then they can. Enforcement officers can choose to confiscate trucks, quads, snowmobiles, airplanes, boats, firearms, fishing gear, like you name it. So, you know, in this case, I think the focus needs to be on this issue that in these jurisdictions, snowmobiles are 100% legal method of hunting. The Wyoming incident could not have happened, or there was an extremely low probability that it could have happened if the snowmobile was not a legal method of hunting. Then everything from start to finish in this thing would have been an egregious violation of the Wildlife Act in Wyoming. But it's complicated, and it's almost like it's watered down, you know, to the $250 fine, because the initial method of disabling this animal and taking possession of it was legal, like up to the taking and possession and transporting of the live animal was legal. So it's remotely possible, but an individual could have shot the wolf in the spine with a 22 and done the same thing. You could legally trap a wolf with a foot restraining trap. And there's ways, you could have taken possession of a wolf that was just held by a foot restraining trap. In that case, it would have been a fully ambulatory and physically fit animal that you would have run the risk of being shredded, trying to get some tape on a wolf's mouth that just had its foot caught in a foot restraining trap. So anyways, the whole issue is that there's a lower likelihood that this incident would have occurred if the fact that running the animal over with a snowmobile in the first place was not a legal form of hunting. So this entire issue to me boils down to the fact that as hunters in a hunting community, we have to reconcile that this running of wolves and coyotes over in Montana and Wyoming, wherever else it happens to be, is currently a legal form of hunting. Now, it's likely that once again, the hunting community is going to weather a storm. This issue will fade and it will disappear from memory. The goal here, in my opinion, for the hunting community shouldn't be to just simply weather this storm. We need to use this as motivation to drive change, to minimize the probability that this wolf incident can happen again the same way. When you're trying to solve problems from a specific incident, to try to elevate that incident to some broad, grandiose thing and say, this is what we have to do to save hunting, you know, worldwide, you're not going to be effective. The way we have to effectively solve problems is incident by incident. We have to say, why did this happen? What caused this to happen? And what can we change so that this can't happen, or the probability of it happening the same way again is minimized or eliminated or reduced? So we need to specifically look at this case, because it is having a huge impact on hunting. We need to look at it from the perspective of how could hunters drive change to minimize it happening the same way again. In British Columbia, the hunting community is very well aware of where this type of thing leads to. And the hunting community in BC is hyper sensitive to the fact of how hunters' actions can bring about an impact to hunting that leads to an outright ban of hunting. In 2016, British Columbia was embroiled in a full-on, no-holds-barred public debate over the future of grizzly bear hunting. the province had tabled an election promise. At that time, it was the NDP party running in the 2017 election that made a election promise that if it were elected, it would ban grizzly bear hunting. After they won the election, a tremendous amount of effort was being done, lobbying, voices being heard from hunters in the province. They managed to convince the new government that this concept of banning grizzly bear hunting because it was trophy hunting, skinning the bear and leaving the carcasses lying on the ground, which had happened. There was organizations that used those photographs as well, to convince elected officials that, hey, there are people that hunt grizzly bears that also retain the meat, even though it's not legally required. So let's solve this issue of grizzly bears being labeled as trophy hunting just for the head and the hide by adding a requirement of meat retention, which is in place for black bears and which is in place for cougars. So it's a way of defending against the fact that the hunting community is endorsing or condoning trophy hunting, in which just a part of the animal is taken and the meat is left in the bush. So anyways, they convinced the new government to include an option, a management option for a modified grizzly bear hunting season that would require the meat to be retained. And that was on the table. It was off the press, ready to go out to see what the public thought of this additional option for grizzly bear hunting. And then two incidents happened in the news. One was that an NHL hockey player was charged with killing a grizzly bear in British Columbia illegally. He grew up in British Columbia, but when he moved to the United States to play hockey, he technically lost his residency in BC, came back to BC, bought a BC resident hunter's license, got an LEH permit for a grizzly bear, went out and shot it, and it was illegal because he was not a BC resident. So that was front page news. Very, very damaging to the efforts that the hunting community had made, the gains that they had made in potentially keeping a grizzly bear hunt. The straw that broke the camel's back in BC was a video that surfaced. It was on YouTube. it was pretty graphic. It was pretty horrific. And it was hunters filmed themselves shooting a grizzly bear in the spring on a snowpack, and they just could not kill this bear. I don't know whether or not they did not know how to shoot properly, if they were using a caliber that was not big enough for an animal, dangerous game animal like a grizzly bear. So anyways, they're shooting this bear. The bear's like roaring and bawling, and it's sliding on the snow plaque, and there's blood everywhere, and they're yelling and hooting and hollering and everything like that. It was pretty bad. And that was it. Game over for British Columbia hunters. That was literally the government pulled the meat retention option to save a grizzly bear hunt in the province off the table, and that's it. Went out to public comment. Do you support the banning of grizzly bear hunting? They got an overwhelming number of submissions, some 60,000 individual submissions that said, yes, ban the hunt. Bang, that was it. Over. So the actions of hunters have a great influence. I don't know where else that this has happened in the world where this type of incident that's gone mainstream in the public discourse has led to a full outright ban of hunting. It has in British Columbia. I mean, Cecil the Lion weathered the storm. Like they're still lion hunting. They were able to defend it and isolate what happened, you know, there. So this, it's kind of a forewarning, you know, for my friends in the United States. We've lived through that here, and there's only so many times you're going to dodge the proverbial bullet of the actions of our colleagues in the hunting community, and we're all going to pay deeply, deeply for those actions. Part of the whole discussion here, getting a little bit more broad, a little more higher level here, is we have a serious problem in the hunting community, and that we have this highly emotionally charged atmosphere whenever we try to have a conversation about the management and the ethics and values around predator hunting. There's a tremendous amount of bullying and hate and intimidation that's directed at all groups of hunters, regardless of how they hunt or the types of hunting. If you come out and say, you know, hey, you shouldn't, you know, be allowed to do X or do Y, there's, you know, sort of say that in the wrong forms. There is a pack mentality. There is a tribalism in certain groups that unleashes, and people tend to get silenced. We don't have dialogue. We have differences of values and ethics and opinions on certain aspects related to predator hunting, that there's a tremendous amount of effort to silence it. And it goes in both directions. Hound hunters and lion hunters tend to get marginalized and chastised by the hunting community for their hunting practices. Hunters often chastise trappers for the methods they use in trapping and the animals that they go after in trapping. And even when there's incidental catches, hunters will unleash on trappers and try to marginalize them. Hunters that speak out about anything to do with, you know, wolves or wolf hunting or predator management tends to elicit that same type of ad hominem type attack the person, right? We don't listen to what other people's values are and have dialogue. We tend to kind of try to silence. And so that makes having these discussions about predator hunting very touchy. Just the fact of talking about, you know, the use of snowmobiles for running down coyotes and wolves in a couple of jurisdictions in the United States is probably going to elicit backlash. And you don't support predator management and you want to see fawns killed and ripped apart and like this type of stuff. It has happened to me before. So I support predator hunting. I support trapping and I support science-based control programs. I support general hunting of predators. Not all predator hunting is predator management. There is an opportunity to hunt predators that encompasses everything that we love about hunting. The challenge, the opportunity to be out there, to go out in the outdoors and be with friends, and the challenge of calling wolves and hunting and like whatever. There's all the aspects. You're utilizing the animal or part of it, the fur. Like there's nothing immoral about that, in my opinion. To hunt wolves as an opportunity to hunt wolves or coyotes and take possession of the fur and hang it as a trophy, whatever you want to call it that, I don't care. You're utilizing the fur. You make something out of it. You sell it to a trapper. It's all legitimate, in my opinion. I fully support trapping. I'm getting into trapping, you know, trying to trap coyotes, you know, and I was caught a fox, you know, like it's fine. Trapping predators is fine. The lethality of traps in Canada, that, you know, we have internationally certified traps. Like I support that. I support objective based predator management, where we're balancing human and predator needs on the landscape. We're not trying to eradicate predators. We're trying to balance what they're taking with what hunters would also like to take. There's a balance, you know, there in this day and age. It's not about eradicating them off the landscape. It's about making sure that, you know, what they do and what they take is commensurate with what, you know, we want to take. And it goes both ways. You know, we got to ensure that there's animals out there for the predators and the energy cycle in nature. I support science-based, professionally led wolf control programs like the ones that are happening in northern British Columbia. They're directly impacting the future of the endangered mountain caribou, and it's essential. It's being led by science. It's being led by professionals that are shooting wolves out of helicopters with Judas wolves that have GPS collars on them. You know, the whole story there, how that's spun in the media. It's a harsh reality of conservation, trying to prevent a species like woodland caribou from blinking out. We're not trying to eradicate wolves. We're trying to keep wolves below a particular threshold, 3 wolves per 1,000 square kilometers, because the caribou can tolerate that. Caribou numbers can grow and the populations can increase if wolves are kept below that threshold of 3 per 1,000 square kilometers. So I support these things. I also support fair chase and ethical hunting principles. So if you follow what I do, recently I've released a couple of podcasts, YouTube videos on under the brand, the Short Truce Canada series. One of them was on a way of assessing a hunting practice against the principles of fair chase. And the other one that I just released a couple of days ago was about a way of assessing what ethical hunting is. So fair chase, the principles of fair chase, how to assess a hunting practice, whether it's fair chase or not, boils down to these two essential questions. Question one, does the hunting practice overwhelm the animal's ability to avoid being detected by the hunter in the first place? The animal's natural evolutionary instincts and adaptations are first and foremost to preserve itself by not being found by a predator. So that is the first question, the first test of a fair chase principle. Does the hunting practice overwhelm the animal's natural abilities to avoid detection? Then the second question is, does the hunting practice overwhelm the animal's natural abilities to evade the hunter once the hunter has detected the prey animal? So the second mechanism of a prey species, instincts and evolutionary adaptations to survive, is that once it becomes aware that it's being hunted, it flees the hunter. It's got great eyesight, great hearing, great sense of smell, intuition, all of these things, and it can evade the hunter. So the question in fair chase, is the hunter using a tool or a technology or a hunting practice that completely overwhelms the animal's ability to elude the hunter once it's been detected? So that's those are the two tests of fair chase. So the question here with the Wyoming wolf incident and the broader question, does chasing and running coyotes and wolves down with a snowmobile overwhelm the animal's ability to evade the hunter once the hunter has become aware of its presence? So the snowmobile probably doesn't help. It may help the hunter find the animal in the first place. But I think the key question of assessing the use of snowmobiles as a hunting, as a legal hunting tool, is the second question. Does chasing coyotes down with a high-powered motor vehicle and running them over overwhelm the animal's ability to evade the hunter once the hunter has become aware of it. Watch some of these videos of these coyotes in these open fields with crusty snow that's a foot deep, and it's trying to outrun a snowmobile, and it's breaking through the snow. It's looking back over its shoulder, and this 800cc machine is running it down. From a fair chase perspective, does that overwhelm the animal's ability to evade the hunter once the coyote and the hunter are aware of each other? The coyote's close enough to the edge of the trees and might be able to beat itself into thick cover before the snowmobile gets there. If it's unfortunate enough to be caught out in the middle of the opening, looking and digging for mice or whatever, it probably doesn't. And yes, a powered machine is probably going to overwhelm that coyote's ability to make it to the timber's edge before the snowmobile can catch up to it. You know, the irony here, the real irony is these two key questions that are a method of assessing a hunting practice against the principles of fair chase come from a framework, from a document that was designed in creating a methodology to assess new hunting tools, technology, and hunting practices against the principles of fair chase. And that framework and those two questions were developed in the state of Wyoming. So my last Short Truths Canada podcast episode was on three questions, three tests that you could ask to assess whether something is ethical in hunting. There were three levels, three tiers, three tests, three questions, whatever you want to call it, that I laid out for folks. The first question, or gate, I like to use the idea of gate, was we asked the question, is the hunting practice legal? Because at the highest level, if a hunting practice is legal, it's actually ethical to society as a whole, because our laws in a democracy are based on the social norms and collective ethics of society. That's how we make laws in a democracy. As social norms and ethics change with each generation, as time passes, our legislators, at direction of our voters, change laws to stay in keeping with current social values, norms, and ethics. So if the hunting practice is still on the table, I know this probably doesn't sit well with some people, but technically it is an ethical form of hunting because society allows it through its democratic process of setting regulations. The second question then underneath of that is it a hunting practice that's generally, broadly, or widely accepted as being a hunting practice by your peers, by the larger hunting community? It doesn't have to mean that everybody in the hunting community agrees, but generally, is that a hunting practice that's widely accepted by your peers in the hunting community? Generally, do hunters in North America feel that the use of archery equipment is an ethical form of hunting? Yes, I think they do. There are a few people out there that go, nope, sorry, it's not as effective as a rifle, shouldn't be allowed, it's not ethical. Great. At a highest level, I believe that archery is accepted by the larger peer community. It's ethical. Ethics is actually at the level of the group, of the peer community. So the third question in assessing whether something is ethical in hunting is the individual level. And this is actually where what they call personal ethics or morals come into. Is it personally moral to you to use a particular hunting tool, technology, or hunting practice? If it's not, you can choose not to do it. Or if it is, you can choose to do it and it is ethical for you. It's passed, the practice has passed through the legal gate. Society says it's legal. The broader hunting community says it's fine. And if you choose it for yourself because you feel it is moral for you as a person, you're the only one that can answer that question, then it passes that test and it's a legal form of hunting for you and the peer group. For example, the use of trail cameras are legal in most jurisdictions. Generally, the hunting community in North America views the use of trail cameras as an ethical form of hunting, an ethical tool or technology in hunting. For me as an individual, it's not. I don't use trail cameras. I don't like to know that there's an animal in the area. I want to take my chances and try to find it with my own eyes and ears. It's a personal choice. I have no problem with other people using it. I'm not trying to say other people are unethical because they do it. I choose to not use it because it's not ethical for me. So there's these, in my mind, these a way of looking at a hunting practice and assessing it, whether it's an ethical standard. So the question here about the idea of a snowmobile being a legal hunting method, running wolves and coyotes over with a snowmobile being a legal hunting, an ethical hunting method. Okay, in those jurisdictions, it is legal. It's actually technically past the larger gate. There are individuals who say, yep, I'm good with it. I hate coyotes, kill them all. I'll run them over with snowmobiles. It's legal. Leave me alone. I don't have an ethical, moral problem with it. Great. But what do your peers say? If you have to stand in front of the court of public opinion to the entire hunting community of North America, what are they going to say? And that to me is the bottom line in this question of the use of snowmobiles, is it a broadly accepted ethical practice of the hunting community, of the broader hunting community? I don't believe it is. I don't have evidence to prove that. It's my intuition, maybe my hopes, that most hunters in North America would be, no, that's not ethical in our collective eyes. Then it's up to that collective community to then change the fact that it is a legal hunting method. And then if a person chooses to do it, then they are completely outside the bounds of ethics because they're doing something that's illegal. One of the consequences of this whole event, the Wyoming wolf incident, is on April 8th, midnight, I believe that's the date, yesterday, an animal rights group in the United States filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government to petition the courts to relist wolves as an endangered species. It cites this Wyoming incident as a premise behind the court case, the filing of the court case. This is how serious this stuff gets. This is what happened in British Columbia with the grizzly bear hunt. Some triggering event happens, and it is almost an insurmountable landslide to overcome the damage that's done. Cecil the Lion incident, even though it didn't stop lion hunting in this jurisdiction in Africa where it happened, it's still a very powerful argument that's brought out in the current debate that's going on in the UK about banning trophy imports from Africa. It's still having an impact on those discussions. It's most likely at some point they're going to win in the House of Lords with the ban in the UK, and that's it. You know, UK hunters will not be bringing anything back from Africa that's going to impact African sovereign nations, their conservation programs, their funding for wildlife management, so on and so on. So these things lead to some serious consequences for hunting that potentially cannot be reeled back ever. I think the animal rights group that filed this petition into the courts in the U.S., they literally had to have all of this ready, all the paperwork done by the lawyers to walk into a courthouse and file a lawsuit. They had it ready, and they were sitting there literally waiting for something to happen like this Wyoming bar incident, so that they can have far greater social impact in winning their court case. There's another organization that's offering a $500 reward. They'll keep whoever anonymous if they come forward. They're looking for more videos and photographs of this incident in Wyoming, because obviously they're going to use that to leverage against the social understanding or the public understanding of what was going on with wolves and wolf hunting in the state, and use that to even put more information out there to the public to sway the public sentiment hunting is of wolves. And if that happens, the hunting opportunity is going to be lost. Trappers' ability to make and supplement incomes will be lost. Game biologists' ability to use hunting and trapping as a management tool to play out this balance that I talked before between hunter harvest objectives and allowing predator prey systems to function, that's going to be removed. So some serious consequences here. In British Columbia, several years ago, the province, hunters, outfitters, trappers in a joint committee went through a process of proactively looking at hunting in the province, looking at tools, technology, and hunting practices, measuring it against the principles of fair chase, which were adopted from the Wyoming framework. Those two questions, like I said, that's kind of highly ironic here. And they went through and evaluated a whole bunch of tools, technologies, and hunting practices in the province. And they came up with 9 hunting regulation proposals that were moved forward to change or prohibit the use of certain hunting practices or technologies under the auspices that they no longer met the principles of fair chase. All 9 of those recommendations went out to the hunting community and non-hunting community for public comment, and there was overwhelming support for those from the hunting community. In fact, a wildlife manager told me that they received more positive comments from the hunting community thanking the government for making these changes to fair chase hunting practices in the province than they have ever received on any topic in the history of public consultation and wildlife management. Hunters thanking the province for proactively making these changes. And, you know, it was things like, you know, there's the use of cell cameras, you know, the trail cameras that can send the signal. So, you know, that was included. Spotting wildlife from aircraft, and relaying that to individuals on the ground. Drones had already been banned under a previous regulation change as not being fair chase. Some weapons were included in the BC hunting regulation changes. The use of spears, L-addles, air rifles underneath of a certain caliber, a bunch of things like that were included. Infrared optics, you know, for night hunting and stuff. Smart rifles were included in it. The rifles that are computerized scopes that can actually lock onto the side of an animal and follow it as it's move. As it moves, it has ballistics, trajectory, distances, angles, all programmed into the scope, and the scope actually releases the trigger on the rifle. The hunter doesn't have to do it. That's a real thing. I didn't know this till I started learning about it. Those were all prohibited in the province as a proactive step. And this prevented these things from blowing up some incident, because the group said these things are likely the things that are also going to trigger some super damaging political event where the outcome is going to be that politicians need to protect themselves from it, so they would impose a ban on something. And as you know, what tends to happen is a bad event happens, and the reaction is a knee-jerk reaction going, oh my God, a hunter used a spear on a bear in BC, and some people got a video and posted it. Okay, ban black bear hunting. That seems to be the way this stuff happens to us in the hunting community. So my message here is the broader one, that BC was actually proactive to some degree, learned their lesson from the grizzly bear thing, in identifying areas of vulnerability and risk to hunting in the public discourse, and proactively took it into their own hands before they had to reactively try to pull something back that was an overreaction. Anti-hunters actually went out there and started trying to lay claims to making all of these changes. And I was very strong advocate of going out there going, no, don't you dare try to claim that you drove these changes in hunting. It was hunters and trappers and outfitters that all sat at the table and took a look inward and said, we want to change. We want to propose these things be changed in hunting. So my bottom line, big message here, it's bigger than the Wyoming wolf incident. This is where all of this has led to. Have you seen that meme that's out there of the little puppet? There's two pictures of the puppet side by side. It's called the side eyes. And so the first picture, he's kind of like glancing out the side of his eyes. Like his head's looking forward, but he's looking sideways out of his eyes. And then the next picture, he's looking forward. And that meme is used for all types of things that acknowledges or makes fun at meme, the situation where people see something, but they choose to look away and ignore it. Don't turn a blind eye to anything in hunting that is, one, illegal, or two, not in keeping with the ethics of the broader peer community in hunting. Don't be that puppet. Don't be that person that turns a blind eye. Have a zero tolerance policy to anything and everything that's illegal, that's impacting the image of hunting, the sustainability of wildlife, or the sustainability or integrity of fish or wildlife habitat. Zero tolerance policy is what I'm advocating here. Be proactive in assessing the risks and vulnerabilities, and make change before change is forced upon us that we don't like. Wildlife is a public trust. It belongs to everyone and it belongs to no one. It's a beautiful concept that's not widely practiced in wildlife management around the world. We're very lucky in North America to have the public trust doctrine that wildlife does not belong to private individuals or corporations or government. It's ours. It's yours. In both the United States and Canada, it's yours. Fight for that. Fight for that every step of the way. Zero tolerance. Fight to keep wildlife in the public trust by not allowing anything that jeopardizes the integrity of sustainable wildlife management or the future of hunting and trapping on this continent. Being able to face the public and defend every aspect of hunting, every little detail of hunting with the truth, and being able to defend it against the North American model of wildlife conservation, the principles of fair chase, and the ethics of the peer community in hunting is paramount. to conserving the future of hunting in the United States and Canada.